Welcome to the Curious Performer Podcast, the podcast for performers who want to grow. Are you ready? Ready to improve your show, to grow your business? Are you ready to build your brand? Then turn up the volume and get ready to hear from some of the best performers in the business. I'm your host, Keith Tussing, and I'll be asking the questions we're all curious about. Today's guest, as a kid, realized that he excelled at all of the things that adults told him were a waste of time. Instead of playing baseball in high school, he built himself a rickety table and rode the bus into downtown to perform magic tricks on the street, and got paid by passing the hat. He's come a long way since then. The Society of American Magicians voted him the best stage magician and close-up magician in Minnesota. He's also been featured 4 times in Linking Ring magazine. Our guest has also written several books about magic tricks for professional magicians. He is a 2-time Guinness World Record holder and has been on NBC's America's Got Talent and in London's Guardian newspaper. Today, we're excited to get to visit with Louis Fox. Louis, welcome to the show.
Hey, it's great to be here. I'm very excited to kind of get out of my house virtually.
Oh, that is so true. So true. Well, I'm glad you're here with us today, and I hope that you enjoy the trip out of the house.
Yes. I always feel like I need right now for these interviews to be like, just so you know, this is recorded in, what is it, February of 2021. We're hopefully at the tail end of the pandemic where we don't go anywhere. So if you're listening to this in 2024, that's why.
Yes, we all are hoping that is over with soon. I think we're headed in the right direction. Well, hey, Louis, I am so excited about getting an opportunity to visit with you. I don't know Louis. I've seen him on at CAX. I just recently saw him at CAX and some of the stuff that he's released on video. But to get to talk to him, I'm excited to learn a little bit about Louis. So let's start right there at the beginning. That's a fun story that in high school, you were doing what?
I was busking. I was a street performer in high school. Yeah, and I suspect most of the money I got was because I was a dopey-looking kid doing card tricks versus I was good at any of it. I still try and go out about once a year to make sure I can still build a crowd and do it. And I can. I flex the muscle a little bit, but that's not what I do anymore.
What led to that?
Basically, I needed a place to perform, right? You can learn to do. So I'm a magician. And you can do tricks at home, you can do them for your friends, but at some point, you got to kind of put a show together. And in high school, there weren't venues for a kid to perform at. So I couldn't go to an open mic because they were all at places that served alcohol, so they were all 21 and up. There weren't just these weird open mics that are everywhere now. It didn't exist. The infrastructure to find these shows didn't exist. So that was the one thing I knew existed and went out and did it.
That's amazing. Now, what led to your interest initially in magic?
I saw a show when I was in kindergarten or first grade at my school. And then I learned a trick. I learned to make a paperclip disappear, which was just on like a rubber band up my sleeve. But I was invited then. I'm this 6 or 7 year old and I make this paperclip disappear. And somehow I ended up in the school's talent show. And I remember being a little kid walking on stage, I was probably one of the youngest people in the talent show, seeing the gym full of families holding this paperclip. And I remember thinking, no one can see this. Paperclip disappeared. And then I called it a day. But with the talent show too, I have this very vivid memory of them basically going, "You're in the talent show tonight, right?" And I was like, I never auditioned because I remember there was auditions too, and I never auditioned. So somehow I was thrust into it.
Oh, that is great. That is great. I have a daughter. She's now 18, but when she was in third grade, she did a talent show and won her talent show. She did 3 little tricks on a stage right out of the red little magic kit, and everybody loved it. But now she has absolutely no interest.
Well, my daughter she's performed in the show. She put herself in the show when she was 4 years old, but she has no interest in being a full-time performer. It's like her summer job that she does with me.
Right.
And she loves it. Her school almost had a talent show 1 year when she was in elementary school. And what she had this idea, she goes, "Here's what I want to do." She goes, "I want to come out in like a tailcoat and have a music stand on stage. I'm like, okay. She goes, I want one of the conductor batons. I want to tap it. She goes, I want to kick the stand over. I want to go, whack, 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 and then drop an egg out of my pants and then leave. I was like, yes. And then the talent show got canceled.
Oh, that's too bad. Everybody didn't get to see that great idea. That's too bad.
Yeah.
So you said magician and you said not busking. So what type of performing do you do right now?
So right now, I'm limited to kind of what I can do for my virtual studio at home, but things are starting to open up. And before the pandemic closed all the performing venues, my core market was performing at fairs, state and county fairs across the country. But I've also done some cruise ship work. I do some theaters. I do some corporate work. But my core market is fairs.
Fairs. Okay. Well, tell me a little bit about that.
I do a stage show, but I also do a street style show. The difference at a fair is you don't ask for money. So it's not really busking in my mind because the motivation is different and you can structure a show differently if you're not trying to get a hat at the end.
Right. Right.
So, and then there's a whole different expectation on the fairgrounds versus in the park or in downtown. So I do a stage show. I also do roving, what we call roving, which is smaller magic tricks, which is, would be classified as close-up magic tricks as well. And that's my first love, is the small card tricks. But I like that they're not my main job because they're still fun to do and learn then.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little bit less work. Where the stage show is work, it's still fun. I love it. It's just, it's not why I got into it.
Right, right. So as you talk about moving from, I'm a high school kid doing magic on the street, and then at what point did you say, this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life?
Pretty early on, I realized the school route wasn't for me. College wasn't for me, and I'm glad I didn't waste, money on college for my career. But now with performing venues shut down, I'm like, well, maybe I should. No, it was one of those things. I realized that I'd be throwing money away on college. Now, I did take a couple college classes because I realized when you fill out like car insurance forms or bank forms, it always asks for your education level. And so it's like, didn't graduate high school, some college, or, and then like, you know, advanced degree. So I took a couple college classes so I can check that some college box.
Some college.
So I think it's paid for itself in the discount on car insurance.
That's great. That's great. What about as you did that, as this became your profession, what kind of maybe early struggles or setbacks did you experience any of that?
Well, one of the hard things was the weird gap from 18 to 21. So you're really limited in venues you can work in. And this is the late 90s, early 2000s. So the internet wasn't quite what it is now. So you couldn't find venues, or if you needed insurance, you couldn't just go to a Facebook group of performers and go, who insures? So it was getting the information needed to kind of pursue the show, to go, you couldn't just Google where's an all ages open mic at that time. That infrastructure did not exist. I mean, we were still on dial-up back then. But that's the thing, is the biggest struggle was the information needed to take the next step. And I didn't really have any formal mentors, but a lot of the people who did help me out were super old school, which is a blessing and a curse. Mm. I mean, because they are very much like, oh, you do this and this. I'm like, that doesn't exist anymore. Like, you can't do that. You can't, you know, no one walks into the newspaper office and a day before their show in town and expects to get on the front page of the newspaper by doing some card tricks for the guy. It's not how it works.
Right, right. And that is something that, you know, our kids will never truly understand, the struggle we went through just to get the information. I mean, mm-hmm. It is so easy. Like you said, just hop on your computer, type in Google. You can find out just about anything you want to know.
Yes. Well, and back then, a lot of people who were full-time performers weren't necessarily good. They were full-time performers by virtue of them just being full-time performers. And it's a weird catch 22, like, well, how do you do it? And, but once you got it, the quality of your act was almost irrelevant.
Mm.
It was that you had a reputation for showing up on time and not pissing anyone off. And that got you a ton of work. You didn't have to be good. And I think that's also partially where like the cheesy magician stereotype comes from, is you didn't need to be good back then.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, it's so true. I mean, whether you're good or bad, and even the things you talk about, showing up time, on time, that is shared immediately. If whatever venue you're working through, you know, if it's a library system, if it's a set of clubs, you know, whatever venue you're trying to work through, that group of people are connected.
Yes.
And they're going to say, if you're good, they're going to let you know. If you're bad, they're going to let everybody know.
Yeah, well, because back then, the associations were still a big thing. So you would have the downtown bar owners association, or you would have the what, and these things still exist. They're different now, but yeah, word would travel a lot. A good endorsement meant a lot more back then if you had someone to champion for you.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so like how to get work was the big struggle. So what I ended up doing, I was 18 years old. I saw an ad in the back of our alternative newspaper that said late night cabaret open mic. Show was at 3 a.m. after the bars closed at a place called Coffee Messiah. And it was a drag show. But I could perform there. Because they didn't serve liquor. So whatever night it was, Sunday night, I would go at 3 a.m. The show would end at 5 a.m. I don't think I had a car or a reliable car. So I would take the last bus into downtown and take the first bus home.
Oh, my goodness.
But it taught me so much because all the people there were they were theater people. They weren't a bar crowd. Who goes to see a show at 3 a.m.? These are all like artsy people. So it taught me kind of how to work a crowd a little bit more and a more adult crowd, because when you're an 18-year-old kid, you don't get a lot of adult crowds. Mm-hmm. So it taught me how to work that. And then the other weird circuit I ended up on was the retirement home circuit, because I had looked when I kind of was 18, I looked at who had hired me before, and I realized they have a monthly entertainment budget. So I ended up writing a book about it too, about how to work that circuit. But it's a great, everyone says you need a place to be bad. I don't agree with that. I think you need a place to get good. There's a different mindset. If you're looking for a place to be bad, you can do that anywhere. If you're looking for a place to get good, that's a whole different mindset, where you're not trading time for money. You're actually actively trying to improve.
Mm. I love that. I love that. Now, what about somebody today, in today's world, somebody that wants to, that walks up and said, hey, Louie, I would love to become a performer. What would be the advice you would give them?
Say yes.
Say yes.
Say yes. Say yes to everything. So many, this is horrible in magician circles, where they go, you don't charge enough. That's not enough money. It takes $800 to get me off the couch. Say yes. That's it. In comedy, in stand-up comedy, there's an old saying, whoever gets the most stage time wins. I mean, I was the house MC at a local comedy club, Giggles Comedy Club, here in Seattle for a year or two. And it'd be amazing the acts that would come in that would be, because I was an interesting slice of time where comedians weren't really working in theaters. They were changing from working in clubs to working in theaters. So you would have these big acts. The next year they came in, they were all working the big 2,000-seat theaters. But that wasn't a thing for comics. It was kind of a weird transition point where, unless you were Eddie Murphy, you didn't work the theater.
Mm.
So you would have like guys like, I remember one night, Jim Gaffigan, who was working the weekend, he came in the night before, went up at the open mic that I was running, and did his 3 minutes.
That's great.
You know, and that's a guy, the next year he came in, he did like 6 sold-out shows for 2,000 people at the big theater. So And then he also frequently, when he's performing at the theater, would still pop by the club and do the open mic.
Mm. Mm.
So it's not about the money. You just say yes, you get the experience.
That's great. That's great. Now, you mentioned comedy clubs and emceeing. You're a comedy magician, but do you also do stand-up?
I used to when I was younger. The longest just straight stand-up set I had was 30 minutes, which is a feature set. And the reason I did it is when you would go on the road doing comedy, some nights were just, you just needed to stand up there and talk. You just needed to fill 30 minutes. And so there was, you're not working on your act that night. You're just a warm body. Mm. So it got to that level. And I've, not too long ago, I looked back at my stand-up set and I'm like, it's not who I am anymore. Cause I was a 23-year-old kid. I'm 42 now. I'm just a very different human being. Mm. Like, it won't work.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so true. I mean, comedy definitely is, you know, good comedy is about life experience and where you are. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's very honest.
Yes.
I have one of my sons that does some stand-up in the Dallas area. And, you know, and even the short time he's been doing it, that's evolved and changed based on his, you know, how he's grown.
Yes. Yeah. It's a very different world. And the world has changed, too. Not just me. But a lot of the stuff I do is not appropriate now.
Yeah. There's so many comedians that say our PC world be the death of comedy.
And I think that's BS, because I'm sure there was in 1963, there was a comedian that was out doing black jokes that was like, this PC world's killing it.
Yeah.
It's the world's changing. You either evolve or you don't. Times change and you got to change with them. Right. That's the thing.
Right. Well, the same thing with magic. I mean, you know, what you were talking about earlier, the idea of what people used to do as magicians is completely different today.
Correct.
What we do on stage and how it's received and how you're perceived has changed a great deal.
Yeah, and that's just it. I think for the most part, if anyone got on stage and pretended for adults to do actual magic, like I'm conjuring this bunny in a hat, you'd be unless it was like a spoof act, you would be laughed off the stage.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so true. What about the idea of branding? I've talked about that a lot with different performers, and I was on your website today, which by the way is beautiful. I love the way that's all laid out, easy to access. And but for you, when somebody says branding, what does that mean to you? How do you use that in your presentation?
All right, so my brand is me. My brand is Louis. I don't have colors. I don't have. When people book me, they book Louis. They're booking a personality. Is that the best way to go? Probably not. Does it work for me? Yes. But my brand is fun. That's what my brand is fun. And so if you see my social media, all that, it's fun. I'm never like, oh, I just had 3 gigs canceled to COVID. Boo. No, I don't do that. And I'm amazed how many people whose brand is entertainment are so negative.
Oh, I totally agree with that. And like you said, you know, sharing negative things on your Facebook page or whatever media you're using is, I think, a terrible idea.
I don't post things that have a side for political stuff. Now, I do post stuff that involves politics, but I don't take a side. So there's that as well. But what's my brand? My brand is me taking a picture of something stupid with my mouth wide open.
Now, we mentioned social media. You know, what platforms are you on? What platforms work for you? How do you use that?
I'm mostly on Facebook because that's where most of the people who book me are. But I'm also on Instagram. I have a Twitter account I don't use, but mostly on Facebook because that's where the people who book me are, and that's where a lot of my friends are. And I'm old. I'm not gonna get on the. I'm not gonna get on the Snapchat.
TikTok's not your thing.
I haven't dug into the TikTok yet. I mean, I have a feeling TikTok's like the Snapchat. I'm not saying it's not gonna stay around forever. But I don't think I'm losing anything by not being on TikTok.
Right, right. So it's a lot of 18 and 20-year-olds. I have a son who's 21 who's kind of blowing up TikTok right now. just with financial stuff, which is very strange. But
yeah. Yeah. I mean, who knew that financial stuff would blow up right now?
Now you mentioned earlier, or maybe in our conversation before we started, your podcast. You do a podcast of your own.
I do a podcast called the Odd and Offbeat Podcast. So it's me and my buddy who's a comedy juggler named Matt Baker. We basically riff on current strange news stories. So you can get that on iTunes, Stitcher, Pocket Cast, all that stuff, or at oddandoffbeat.com. And how we started doing this, we our episode 144 just came out this morning.
Wow, that's great.
So we do it weekly. So we've been doing it for a couple of years now. And it's an excuse for us to hang out. And but it makes us be creative in a way that's outside of our shows. Because we have to write jokes now that are about news stories, not about my life or this prop. So it's a way to flex a creative muscle.
That's good.
And then we do another podcast, which is there's a variety arts festival in Seattle, which is the longest running, largest variety arts festival in the world, called the Moisture Festival. So we do their podcast where we interview their performers and figure out how they got into it, how they got to the festival, all that as well. So that's an interview format, which is basically we interview someone, Matt and I make funny comments, and then the guests shut us down. They're like, no, we're not into that. It's a lot of fun.
Oh, that's great. Now, what's the name of that podcast?
The Moisture Festival Podcast.
Moisture Festival Podcast. All right. We'll have to check that out. Now, as you've been doing this for how long? You said you're 41, so that, what is the math, 22 years?
Yeah. Well, I've been doing it as a job since I was 18. So, yeah, 20-something years.
So
now I've made a living for it. Less than that.
Okay. But now think about that for a minute. You're talking to performers. Basically, that's our audience. Mm-hmm. And both newbie performers and people that have been doing this for a while, what would you say is the critical element for success?
Be unique. Whatever it is. So if you're someone that has, you know, getting back to kind of like some branding, like there's Chef Bananas, you look at him, you're like, that's Chef Bananas.
Yep.
Right? And he could do the most standard tricks in the world. It's still Chef Bananas. You see me, I do unique stuff, but I'm a generic looking guy. So, but what you need to find what it is that's unique about you and amp it up. So like bookers, they book me because I'm going to do something no one's ever done at their fairground. And that's, I think, one of the biggest elements is just do something different. Like, what is your art? And think of it that way. You know, is it an art or are you trading tricks for money? I do art. But the bookers I work, they're super savvy. Like the man in the balloon act where you get in a giant 5-foot balloon, right? That's a pretty novel thing until you go to a fair showcase or a trade show and you see 8 people do it.
Oh.
And that's the thing is within, once you get into a market with that have established bookers, not like a birthday party mom or a one-off corporate person. Once you get to agents and event planners, they see stuff and they know the difference. So that's the person you have to impress is the gatekeeper. So like, you know, if people get in the balloon, that's great. If you've never seen it before, it loses a lot. If you've seen it before.
It's so true. Let's talk about that for just a minute. You've mentioned fairs a couple of times. What is that like? I mean, you roll in. How long are you there for the fair? What is that like, a fair life for a magician?
All right. So I'm a fly-in act. And so, what that kind of means is I don't travel with a trailer. I mean, I drive to a lot of stuff, but I can also fly. So I don't travel with a trailer. I don't bring a stage. I will sometimes bring a sound system if I know ahead of time that I'm doing street shows. But all my stuff fits in an airline case that goes under the plane. My show fits in that. And typically, this is all changing. We'll see once they have to social distance audiences. So pre-2020, it was you would do 3 shows a day. You'd show up. Maybe I could show up the morning of the show because I didn't have any real setup the first day. you set up, you do three shows a day. One of the hard things is you're sharing the stage with so many other acts. Mm-hmm. So you have to strike your show each set and then move it back out. And some places leave zero changeover time. Some places leave changeover time. So that's, for me, the biggest challenge is starting my show on time, but purging the audience. And what I mean by that is a lot of people who schedule it go, oh, we'll have this show, and they'll start with only a couple minutes between the two shows so that people stay. Mm. I don't want that. If you're there for the cloggers, 90% of those people aren't my audience. So I want to turn that audience and build a new audience, which is a weird theory for performing. Who wants to make an audience leave? But I don't want someone who's not into my show taking up a space for someone who is. Mm. And so how I do that is before my show, my crowd builds is I tell jokes. I might do a trick or something I'm working on, but it's to get people used to my personality. And hopefully if they don't like it, they will leave.
Before the actual start of the show.
Yes. Yeah. So, but the industry, I mean, you go, you stay in a hotel for the week, or you stay at a friend's house for the week. Some fares put you up, some don't. It's all over the map. There's no real standard as to how that goes. Hmm. I have some that they go, we don't book the hotel, but here's an extra $150 a day. Book your own.
Hmm. And you mentioned Showcase, that yes. That's where you go to get exposure to be invited to the fair.
Correct. Yeah. And that's something I think a lot of family performers don't do or know how to do or are aware of are showcases. And virtually every industry has these. So the library industry has showcases. The parks and rec department has showcases. The PTAs have showcases. So it's just like that. It's a big convention, and then they have acts do anywhere between 8 and 20 minutes, depending on the place, and bookers watch them. And then that's how you get the work. So standing out helps. Like the amount of country places that sing, there's one, oh shoot, I can hear it in my head. I can't remember the song though. But there's a song they all play. You know, it's not, if I see a fiddle on stage, someone's going to play Devil Went Down to Georgia. So there, when an act does something unique, it really stands out.
Yeah. And that's what you said from the beginning, is to be unique. And certainly if you're up there with a lot of performers at the same time, that's a bonus to make sure that you are completely unique from everything around you. I've been to a couple of library showcases, and you're right. You see some things just repeated over and over again.
Well, like with magicians in the library, they do that card. It's a great trick where they're like, oh, that's your card. That's my favorite card. It's my library card. And they turn it over and it's a generic library card. I mean, it's not a bad trick, but when you're the fourth person to do it.
What about as performers, some people are that you think we should know or be aware of that maybe you follow, or that you would encourage others to say, hey, if you're going to be a professional, this is somebody's name you should know?
Okay, so within the fair industry, first of all, let me say, here's who you should know. You should be a consumer of whatever industry you want to work in. So if you want to work in the library circuit, go to libraries. Don't just go to your local library. One time I got a tour, it was an 8-library tour, because I was on the road going somewhere else and there was a rural library and I had to pee. So I went in and then I chatted up the guy, and next thing I knew, he booked me for 8 shows.
Mm.
But you have to, I mean, I don't know if using the bathroom at the library is a consumer of it, but being, well, I also looked at the magic books. That's how the guy chatted me up, not in the bathroom or anything weird. But that's the thing, is you go to a fair. If you want to work on cruise ships, you go take a cruise, understand the industry, and then you'll figure out who the players are. So in the fair industry, when I first kind of got into it, someone introduced me to a guy named Alan Bruce. He's not a magician. He knows some magic tricks, but he's not a magician. but he is one of the most creative people I know and has given me some of the best advice.
Hmm.
And within that industry, Alan, he sees the trends. He knows kind of what's happening. He's not just showing up doing his thing, and he does a lot of crazy things, but he is someone to know because he knows where things are going. And he's personal friends, not just business relationships, with a lot of the movers and shakers within the industry. So he knows a lot.
Hmm.
So find someone that knows a lot about your industry. It's going to be different in every industry, but find that person.
We've talked about clients, you know, and getting booked, things mm-hmm. like that. Once you're booked, what are some things that you do to build a rapport so that you become a return, you know, get a return invitation without some of all the work, maybe?
I'm easy to work with.
Mm.
Number one, I'm easy to work with. That gets you so much work. When I show up, someone gave me early on working in the fair industry is they go, if you see no, Hilby, the tall, skinny German juggle boy told me this, who is amazing. He's out of, I think, the Boston area. He is phenomenal. He said, if you never see management, you're doing something right. Mm. They show up when there's a problem, or they show up because they love your show. But if management never talks to you, that's perfect. So you show up, you do your thing, you clearly articulate to them what you need, get it, do your show. You don't need the boss to watch you. They know what's going on. They hear things. If the show is good, they hear. If the show is bad, they hear. But that's the key, is just being easy and communicating. So I always send, you know, the email a week before. It's like, hey, looking forward to being here. Whatever the show is, you get an email from me a week before. That's just, hey, looking forward to being here. A lot of public events and private ones now, depending on what it is, I send a little video. It's the same trick. It's a cookie cutter thing, but it's me doing a trick. Like, hey, I'm excited to be at blah, blah, blah. And then I do a trick of card changes. And then I'll see you on Wednesday at 2:00. And I just go record a month's worth of them in an hour and chop them up and send them out and schedule it in my email. They go out. But that's a little touch that shows I care.
And it's so true, being easy to work with. You know, you hear about people that are just difficult. And if I'm a decision maker, the last thing I want to deal with is a difficult person.
Yes.
The other thing is, be on time. Just show up when you're supposed to.
Well, and that's the thing. Early on, working on the road in comedy, I was working with a guy, Brad Brake. He goes, we're not paid for the show. We're paid to get there on time. but that's just it. You know, be easy. Don't give them any reason to worry. Like, I'm frequently, if I know there's a traffic delay that won't really affect things, but it will, because I always show up, let's say, for just a regular whatever show. Like, I'm going to whatever elementary school to do a school assembly. I arrive 30 minutes before. That's all I need. But if I'm in traffic, I can set up in 7 minutes if I have to. But they're expecting me 30. And if I know I'm going to be 25 minutes early, I'll just send them a quick note. Like, hey, I'm stuck in traffic. I'll be there 25 minutes before showtime, not 30. Don't want you to worry.
Yeah. It's so easy to communicate clearly with all that we have access to, even in our car. Just being conscientious for the person that you're in contact with so they don't worry. It's so important.
And that comes from, I don't really produce shows with other performers, but I've done a handful, and it's always that guy that's running late that just makes me want to, you know, pull your hair out. So how can I not be that guy? That's my goal, is to not be the guy that drove me nuts when I produce shows.
Right, right. I mean, in my job now as a performer, but prior to that, was involved in ministry for 25 years. And the worst thing, you know, you're making a decisions for an auditorium of 2,000 teenagers, and you've got a guy that's supposed to come in, you've paid them, he's going to be there to perform, and you're looking at your watch, you're wondering what the heck is going on, and your stress level just is magnified when
because
it's
you're
late.
You're going, what's my plan B? What if the guy's actually in trouble? Like, yeah. You know, what if he's in a car accident 3 blocks away and I can walk over and help him or whatever? Yeah, it's, I totally agree that just that, that little communication for any delay is huge.
It really is.
I mean, I used to produce a cabaret for this exclusive club here in Seattle. Like, everyone did 3 to 5 minutes, and I think it paid $300 an act, and they wanted like a 40 minute show, or not even 40 minutes, but yeah, it was like this high budget. You just went in, you did your best short set, and the amount of acts that I'm like, I'm paying you an insane amount of money for 3 minutes. You can't get here at your call time.
The other thing is riders. When you're booking people in and they've got these ridiculous requests in their riders, I've had that before, and you're like, seriously, we're already paying you. What is this about?
Yeah. Well, okay. So that's another huge thing is all-inclusive pricing. How many magicians I'd go like, oh, it's whatever plus mileage. I don't want to figure that out. Just tell me what it costs. I know a lot of people that in the fantasy go, oh, it's my daily rate is this plus hotel plus airfare. Like, I don't want to figure that out if I'm booking you. I don't want to figure it out for me, but I do.
Yeah, and then that goes back to be easy to work with. I mean, you think about those things, and those are bottom line things. Be easy to work with, show up on time, do a good job. Mm-hmm. I mean, do those three simple things, and you'll be booked. I mean, it really is.
Here's a little story. I was booked for a fair at the Watermelon Capital of the World. And so when
now, wait, the guy was, where's the watermelon capital of the world?
Umatilla, Oregon. So I was joking with the booker, and I'm like, you got to include a watermelon. So he's like, okay, sure. So I get the contract, and it doesn't have a watermelon on it. So I write, I put a plus a watermelon, initial it and send it back. And he had the biggest laugh over that. But so that's being fun and easy to work with. So I do the gig. It's great. He pays me at the end of it. And he goes, oh, shoot. He calls me like the day after it's over. He goes, I forgot to give you a watermelon. He goes, looks like I have to book you back next year.
Oh, you a watermelon.
So he booked me back the next year just to give me a watermelon.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
So it'll be fun, but be easy too. I also wasn't like, where's my stinking watermelon?
It just goes back to, you know, the whole idea of the golden rule. You know, treat people the way you want to be treated, and it makes a huge difference.
Well, if you look at it this way, everyone who hires me lets me do my art. I use that very loosely. But do what I do. They pay me. I'm not out digging ditches. I'm not out. No one's going to die because of my show. No one's going to live because of my show. I just am out having a good time, and they are sponsoring me as an artist. Like, why make it hard on them?
What about the idea of continuing education? What kind of advice would you give? What things would you suggest?
So attend whatever you can. You can learn from anything, whether it's like a magic lecture, whether it's a convention. You know, you can learn a ton from going to like a dental convention because they're speakers, right? So you can watch them. You can watch how the people in the trade show operate. There's a ton to learn for everything if you're looking. And I mentioned Alan Bruce earlier in the fair industry. I don't know if he still does. He mentioned he used to just go and attend every year a convention for something, an industry he's not in. And it just gives you like depth as a person to know about other things, but you can see how all these other large events work, but there's tons that you can learn from anything. So I see as much live and currently virtual shows as I can, but it's not just watching them. It's processing the information. So I write notes on them. What did I like? What did I not like? How can I apply, say, this lighting to my show or this idea to my show? And if you're curious about my daily writing, I write every day as well, just regardless. I have a daily blog, which is www.magicshow.tips. So you can see my impressions of shows I've seen or tricks I've seen or performers I've seen, in addition to what I'm working on, all that stuff. But like, always be working on something, always be reading something. There's always something to learn. I was on vacation with my family when I was working on a soap bubble act, and we were at Disney World, I think, and we saw a show and they used a lot of confetti. And I was like, oh, that's really interesting. So I started playing with confetti, and now I have a bit I do with my soap bubbles where whenever they pop, confetti shoots out of them. And that came from watching a parade at Disneyland. So there is stuff everywhere if you look. But, you know, the person putting together that parade at Disney probably went to school for some sort of theater. I didn't. So I can watch that. I can learn from it. Mm. And there's so much to learn from everything.
That's good. That's really good. Hey, we've mentioned virtual a few times, mm-hmm. Just the world we live in right now. And you do some virtual shows?
Yes. Yeah, I perform virtually a couple different ways. I do a full show. My buddy Matt Baker, who I do the podcast with, we try every month to put on a show as well, which is a variety show, which is one of the ones that makes me want to pull my hair out because I have to deal with other acts. and then I like pop in as an act within other virtual shows. Okay. And what stresses me out about them is the stuff that's out of my control, which is all the tech stuff. Cause I don't know, you know, if my internet gets laggy, there's nothing I can do about it in the moment.
Right.
If, I had a camera capture card go out 5 minutes before a show. And so you got to figure out what you're going to do with that and how you're going to deal with that in real time. And that's stress I don't want right before I go up. And a virtual show is new. It's not something I've done 10,000 times like my other shows.
Yeah, everybody, I think, has had to learn a lot over the, you know, this stretch of time where things had to be totally different and not anything that you were really trained to do.
Correct. Yes, it's not what we were trained to do. You have to essentially, for the average solo performer, you have to learn a new show, because a virtual show isn't simply doing your show to a camera. And I was lucky early on. I realized that at the end of March, I was like, oh, that you can't just turn a camera on and do your show. It's not going to work. So I was lucky really early on. I realized that, but you also have to learn the tech end. You have to learn to produce it. And you got to learn to produce it by yourself while you're performing. I'm lucky my daughter produces most of my shows, so I have a second human in the room. And that's the biggest thing that makes the show work, I think, is my goal is to make my daughter laugh. That's it. And that gives me my energy, but it makes me push my show further because she's heard all the jokes in the show. So how do I make her laugh within the show? And that makes me try.
What do you see as the future of virtual as we continue down this road and as we all hope that things are going to get back to a semblance of normal? Do you see that hanging around?
I think it'll still be around in some context. So a couple nights ago, I just did a hybrid show, which was a socially distant live audience and an audience on Zoom. It was interesting because the camera was 90 degrees from the audience. So which do you play to?
So what did you do?
If I was talking, I played to the live audience because the people could still, I kind of played a diagonal. So the people on camera could still see me talk and whatnot, but I did the tricks to the camera. And the reason for that, my thinking was the live audience, because they were socially distant and what they were allowed in the space was only like 20 people. The Zoom audience was at least 40. So I was playing to the majority of the crowd.
And how did you feel about that as it went on and then after you were done with it?
When I was done with it, I would probably, if I ever did one again, I would probably ask, because there was the first one they had done, so they didn't know what they were doing either. Probably ask or suggest they put the camera with the audience, so you're not playing to two different groups. But I mean, it was fun. I learned a lot. but going forward, I think you're going to see more of that in the near term, because these venues can't make money at 25% capacity.
No.
So you have to sell the virtual end. So I think it'll stick around that way for a while. And then I think venues will go, wait a minute, if I have the show, Let's say they're back at 100% capacity, but someone from Milwaukee will pay to watch it. And we already have this infrastructure in place. Why not? So I think there's going to be this hybrid thing. But I also think, especially in corporate work, there's like going to be a lot of work virtually because you don't have to hire a guy to travel now. And then you can include the crew from around the world in this.
Yeah, and I have my oldest son. He's in Kansas City, and they haven't been in their office for almost a year. He does everything from home, all of their meetings and everything. I can see the same thing with what you just said with performance. Is hey guys, we're gonna bring in this guy, and you guys can hang out at home and watch the show. They still get the benefit of the entertainment, a shared experience, but they all are back at home.
Exactly. And it's interesting how prices have changed. I mean, early on, everyone was discounting. Now everyone's charging more than they were charging in person.
It's more work.
It is. I mean, I have to set up a studio every time.
Yeah.
But, you know, so I think going forward, it's going to be a thing. It's also, I mean, I think like school assemblies will always be there. I think once you get the kids back and they can congregate, I think the advantage from a human level of having a school assembly is having someone physically there versus watching a movie.
Right. Right.
But then, you know, I've done school assembly tours where they get snowed out. That snow day doesn't exist anymore.
So, yeah, I think that there is, like you said, I agree completely. There's going to be some kind of continuation going forward with virtual. We just have to figure that out as we go.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. As we get to the point of wrapping this up, I want you to think for just a minute, and you're speaking to other performers, the top three things you think that lead to becoming a successful performer.
One is uniqueness. So having a unique product or, you know, or at least a unique looking product. So there's someone like Artie Loon, who's a Southern California magician. His show looks like something you want to book. Mine doesn't. Just based on his props, you're like, I want that. So it doesn't have to be a unique show like I do, but just having a unique, I guess that comes down to a sort of a branding thing, whether it's, I mean, my brand is fun and weird crap. So the next one is willingness to take risks. Whether that's like, whether it's, you know, taking a risk in your show, doing something weird, or taking a show maybe that would be a challenge for you. I mean, we all know shows that are going to be a pain in the butt, and there's different kinds of pains in the butt. There's a pain in the butt where you're like, oh, it's going to be hard to get paid. That's not a good risk. There's a pain in the butt where you're like, oh, they're having me in the center of the room and the audience is off to my left and my right, and in front of me is a wall. Learn to work that room. It sucks, but learn to it doesn't fill your soul. You don't leave there going, I'm champion. So I used to do a comedy tour where we would do this casino, and they had, it was a high stage, and then there was 50 feet of dance floor. And the only reason I showed up to it was to try and break that room, but that was a risk. Like, I knew I was going to do horribly in that room every time. And once I finally broke that room and did well, never went back. There's no need, but I was taking a risk. I was trying stuff three times a year at that room to figure out how to break it. So take risks in your show, whether it's, you know, a big risk I take in the show, there's a point where I need to go off stage and get in a dinosaur costume. So it takes about 30 to 45 seconds to do. So I leave someone on stage, I tell them to dance. And 99% of the time they dance. It's a huge risk. I don't know what that person's going to do.
Yeah.
You know, I'll give a kid a microphone and tell them to tell a joke. And if they tell a dirty joke, it's the best. Like, that's the scenario you want. But but by taking those risks, it makes stuff real. Something is really happening now. We're not just watching a show that I do every time. And I think that what makes a show successful is not how tight it is, but how real it is. And the last one is discipline. So I get up in the morning, I edit a podcast, I then write. And so my day up until noon is pretty scheduled. I learn some Spanish, walk the dog, but it's having that discipline. I mean, pre 2020, instead of walking the dog and learning Spanish, that was returning emails and phone calls in that slot. So just having a schedule you stick to and do, instead of just like, oh, I'll write when I need to. I write every day. I'll, you know, having a block of time for returning phone calls helps with your day.
So the review is take a risk, have discipline. And the third one was
be unique.
All good stuff. Really good stuff. Well, Louis, I have really appreciated you taking the time to do this today, to hang out and share with everybody. Let's go over again the things that you have available. Just run through podcast, website, stuff like that. If people want to find you, where do they find you?
Sure. So you can find my daily magic blog at magicshow.tips. You can listen to the Odd and Offbeat podcast on iTunes, Google Play, all that stuff, or oddandoffbeat.com. And then the Moisture Festival podcast, just search that. It's in all the podcast outlets. And you can visit me at louisfox.com or shoot me a like at facebook.com/louisfoxshow.
Very good. Those are all great places. I'll be checking out the ones I haven't been to before. Again, thanks so much for taking the time to be here, Louis. I truly appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you.
If this is your first time tuning in, I encourage you to subscribe to the show so that you can hear all the great episodes that we have coming up in the next few weeks.